November. Next week is Great Shit. Well, actually, I'm friends with Rashida Webb, who is from Alberta, and also CISA, and he's an expert on something we haven't had here before, which is really hard for astrophysics. And he's going to be talking about numerical simulations of synthesis of heavy elements in quark or neutron stars that is having to do with phase transitions in neutron stars. So, some real science. and when he said to be an extremely good speaker. The next week, the 14th, we have Rob Colton from Toronto, who is a particle physicist who's going to be talking about recent work in foundation quantum mechanics using a kind of stochastic quantization of field theory. Then, in January, we have two talks, Julian Oriat, also from Alberta, talking about nano stuff, nano fabrication, nano technologies. And Laura Morris, University of Florida, talking about, will give us an update on dark matter searches. And then on February 1st, we have some guy called Anthony Valentini, who is going to be talking about the CMB. Now, the CMB is also part of the topic of today's talk. We're very, very happy to have Peter Coles, who is a distinguished astrophysicist and cosmologist from NanoCamp. He is the first, according to your webpage, professor of astrophysics.
Could be the last.
University. I'm not going to go, he started in Cambridge and went to Sussex and then London and has been in Nottingham for a little while, and he's been this term visiting at CISA, and he's been telling us about statistical challenges and cosmic weirdness.
Can we have the lights down a little bit? Right. Okay, thanks Lee, it's nice to be here. What I want to talk about today is I'll try to give a sort of title which more or less covers everything that I could talk about, and I'll select a few things that I've been working on recently, which all kind of somehow connect to this idea of something either statistical or weird, or both. And I hope it all hangs together in a reasonably coherent way. Now, if you're anything like I was when I was an undergraduate doing physics, if anyone talked about statistics, I just ignored them. Because I thought statistics was something that, you know, biologists and economists and people like that had to do, but physics was, you know, kind of right or wrong, you didn't really need statistics. One of the themes of this talk is that actually cosmology is really statistical now, and you've got to deal with it. And dealing with it in the way that will help you to try and find out if there's anything weird going on in the cosmological world is actually quite difficult. And if you want to leave now, that's basically the message of the talk. But this isn't a new idea. I found this quote, it's about 40 years old, by a very famous and distinguished relativistic cosmologist called George McVitie, who wrote that sentence at the beginning of, it's in the preface to the proceedings of a Berkeley symposium on stochastic processes in the 1960s. And this particular work that was being done in the statistics community at the time led to what some of you may know as the Neyman-Scott processes, which are still used in the modeling. Variations on those are used in the modeling of galaxy clustering now. So then, anyway, this view is not a new one, but it is essential, as George McVitie would have said. It's worth actually as a historical digression. I have too many digressions, I'll never get started, but basically all of statistics was invented by astronomers. If you think, it's true.
No, it's not.
The good bits were invented by astronomers. You see, if you look at the founding principles of probability theory are due to Bernoulli and Laplace, both of whom were astronomers. Gauss, the central limit theorem, was an astronomer. Bessel, The list is endless of famous astronomers.
I think people who studied games of chance also played a big role.
Yeah, it's true, but the classic work on the probability theory of games of chance was Jacob Bernoulli, who was an astronomer. Ars Cogitandi. Yeah, as well as many other things. He did the, I mean, there was a huge family of Bernoullis as well. Anyway, I don't want to... That wasn't the point that was going to be controversial. If you say that in an audience of statisticians and geneticists and people like that, they really get upset because it bypasses people like Golden and Pearson and all those other great figures. But anyway, you get what I mean. Anyway, so the point of the talk is that we now have this kind of broad brush picture of the evolution of the universe from very early on in the beginning, near the Big Bang, the singularity, not quite there, but a little bit after. Let's use this. See, tiny fraction of a second there. Probably in 100 years' time, that part of the slide will still be accurate. The picture that we have is not just one of a homogeneous and isotropic universe. That's the background, of course, but there is a model that explains, or at least tries to explain, how the galaxies and large-scale structure that in the universe that we see now arose as a result of perhaps inflation, or at least density fluctuations laid down by some primordial process early on in the evolution of the universe. Now, I'm not claiming that this is absolutely right. We don't really know whether it is or not. It certainly hangs together in a fairly coherent way. But what we can say is that it's a useful working hypothesis. And what we should be doing as scientists is to, what you should always do with a working hypothesis, that's to try and test it. So this view of the universe has now become known as the, you know, for years the game of cosmology was to pin down the parameters that describe the background cosmology, the density parameter, the expansion rate, all of these things. And with the accumulation of redshift surveys, supernova measurements, and CMB, we now have this concordance model, which sort of fits all the data reasonably well. And I've used this kind of beautiful thing to show what concordance is. You see this. There's everyone in agreement there on the knees. There's all in heavenly harmony. There's lots of press coverage, as indicated by heralds here, and everything is wonderful. But if you just step back from that for a moment and try to get a sort of more balanced view, you see, actually, there's plenty of scope for finding weird things going on underneath this. Now, I don't pretend to know exactly what Hieronymus Bosch had in mind when he was drawing all this stuff. But there's clearly a lot of things going on here that couldn't be deduced from this level of the picture. I don't know what's going on here, but I think it's fairly obvious that these are graduate students. So anyway, what I want to do is... let me just backtrack on this. What I want to do is to basically say that is to work out how we can go through cosmological observations and try and find out if there is any evidence for any of this kind of stuff, given that everyone seems to like the stuff that's sitting at the top there. So just a quick outline. I'm going to concentrate on a few different aspects. I'll explain what these things are as we go along. And... I'm going to talk a lot about Fourier transforms and information in the Fourier transforms of theta, because when I was an undergraduate student, my tutor in physics told me that if you didn't know what to do, the first thing you should do is Fourier transform everything. So that's what we're going to do here. And I'll just show you some illustrations. Clearly struck a chord with something. So, and then I'm going to sort of expand on some of these ideas and then go off and talk about other weird things that happen to come up on the way. So I now have a technical definition of what I think of as weirdness. You know, what is weird for some people is not weird for others, so this definition won't do for all of you. But as someone coming from a sort of theoretical statistics background, I think this is a good definition of weirdness. some aspects of the possible weirdness that might be in the universe. So this concordance cosmology is an example of what I would call a first order cosmological model. Basically, it describes a homogeneous and isotropic universe onto which there's some density fluctuations are imprinted very early on by some process that we like to think we know about, but maybe we don't really. So in all of this class of models, and including in this model is not just the concordance cosmology, but the old version, standard cold dark matter model with a big density of dark matter and no vacuum energy. In all of these models, there's a particular assumption made about the form of the initial fluctuations. That's what's imprinted on the back on top of this homogeneous and isotropic universe. And that is that they form a Gaussian random field. You've probably heard this a lot in different talks. You get Gaussian fluctuations from the simplest versions of inflation. So Gaussian fluctuations, not just Gaussian, but also statistically homogeneous and isotropic. That means that probabilistically speaking, everywhere is the same, and the statistical correlations don't depend on direction. Now, I like to think of this as being, as it is, a kind of assumption from ignorance. Because although you can motivate this from inflation, there are inflationary models, maybe weird ones, where you don't have Gaussian fluctuations. But in some sense, this assumption is the least informative in this initial conditions that you can have. If you take a probability distribution and you fix the amplitude, the variance of that probability distribution, and you say, what is the maximum entropy distribution that I get just fixing the variance? The answer is a Gaussian. So this generalization of this is to say, well, suppose I know something about the spectrum of fluctuations, what the amplitude is on different scales. What is the least informative generalization of that to the whole probability distribution? And the answer is a Gaussian random field. So anything other than that, I'm going to take to be weird. Now, you might be working on non-Gaussian fluctuations from inflation, some of you, and therefore you don't think it's weird. But that's my definition. So now that's a bit sort of informal, but let me just say this as a physicist, as a statistician would say it. And you realize you might think it's quite easy to test whether things are Gaussian or not. You know, it's one of the things you do, you plot the graph, the histogram looks Gaussian, you say it's Gaussian. And do a goodness of fit. Actually, what this means is a lot, and it's quite hard to test it in generality. In fact, it's impossible to test it in generality. Because a Gaussian random field specifies an awful lot of information constraints on what the random field has. It's not just, if you look at the distribution of temperature fluctuations, they have a Gaussian distribution. It means that all of the multivariate distributions of 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 1,000 points, they're also Gaussian. So if you've got, say, 10 million data points, there are 10 million different distributional constraints here. It's kind of difficult to test all of those with a finite data set. So the form that you need to test for is this multivariate Gaussian here. Now, physicists don't usually talk about those things. They usually talk about, I'm going to skip that little bit. They usually talk about what the, not probability distributions, but what the sample looks like, what the morphology and distribution of temperature fluctuations actually looks like in your data set. And I'm going to sort of get into working, this kind of thing that I'm talking about works best for the CFB, for reasons which will become obvious later. But I'm going to sort of motivate it by talking a little bit now about Fourier phases and Fourier information in three-dimensional density fields. So imagine you're looking at the distribution of galaxies in space. Now, so as I said before, the usual thing that you do is if you have a measured density field, this is the dimensionless fluctuation in the density of stuff somewhere, or any other related fluctuation field. And you expand it in Fourier modes like this. And of course, the Fourier transform is a complex number. So it's got an amplitude and a phase. And if you have a Gaussian random field, In other words, if this fluctuating field is a realization of that statistical kind of prescription that I gave you before, then what will happen will be that the phases of all the Fourier modes are random. And I think you can see why this is then a massive and entropy thing. You basically specify the amplitude of the phases, that gives you the equivalent of the variance, but how they all correlate with each other is that they don't correlate with each other, they don't know about each other. There are loads of physical processes where this happens. Waves on the surface of the sea is a great example. The distribution of wave heights is very Gaussian because it's basically a linear process and everything acts. And the phases of different modes don't correlate until they get near the shore, because then it goes non-linear. Now, the only difference to this from this is that the universe is real, or at least should be, so there is a constraint on the phases of these conjugate modes here. That's kind of obvious. The other thing that's worth noting, because I'll show you this later, is that the difference in phases between two different K modes should also be random, provided you do 2 pi properly and think of angles as they should be thought of. Okay, so I'm going to skip this basic. Just in case some of you don't know what this is, when I talk about homogeneous and isotropic, I mean statistically homogeneous. Here, are the other word that's used in the literature for this is stationary. So what that means is that the statistical, if you imagine, if you really want to be a frequentist and think about probabilities as ensembles over and with some kind of proportion over an ensemble of realizations, here are Gaussian processes which are not stationary. And see, across the ensemble, the variance at this point is smaller than the variance at other points. So that's although if you make the distribution of any one realization of this, you'll get it to be Gaussian. Okay? Across the ensemble, the variance at this point is different to the variance at other points. So that's statistically inhomogeneous. So if you have a Gaussian random field, such that at every point the variance is modulated in some way, then that's not homogeneous, just in case you didn't know about that. I'm going to skip the next slide. Right, so why is it important? What I'm going to talk about is information that's in these phases. Why is it important? Well, you've probably seen pictures like this or from other surveys. This is the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey. Which is about 250,000 galaxies measured, their positions are mapped out in redshift. It's a spectroscopic survey, and you see this is the so-called cosmic web. You see the distributed galaxies are not homogeneously distributed, they're clustered together in quite large-scale structures. And if you might ask yourself, and what people do with these things is measure the power spectrum of the survey. So it's just a there's umpteen different versions of this available on the web, I've just shown you one. This measured power spectrum can tell you quite a lot about the underlying model that you think has given rise to this large-scale structure. Now, what I've got here, let me skip back a little bit here. The power spectrum is basically the square of the amplitudes of the Fourier mode, so it has no information about the phases. And yet when people do large-scale structure surveys like this one, they measure the power spectrum, and that's what gets the headlines. So if I just sit back here, here's 2 simulations. This is this kind of bubbly filamentary structure that you find in a galaxy survey is very similar to what is actually produced naturally by gravitational clustering from Gaussian initial perturbations. As they evolve, they get non-linear, you get these sort of sheets and filaments. What I've done here is just taken an n-body simulation like this and taken Fourier transformed it and then randomized the phases of the Fourier modes. So reassigned the phases of each Fourier mode to the other modes, preserving the reality condition, and then Fourier transformed back. So what you have there on the right is a distribution where the amplitudes of all the Fourier modes are the same as the amplitudes in this one, but the phases are scrambled. So this picture here has exactly the same power spectrum as this picture there. Exactly the same. In fact, more than that, it has exactly the same amplitudes of all the modes, which is a stronger condition. So you can see, I think this, more than any equations or words will tell you, that virtually all of the information about the morphology of the galaxy clustering pattern, all of these edges and filaments and so on, is not in the power spectrum. It's in the phases somewhere. Now, this is not what I would call cosmic weirdness. These models start out in the early universe with Gaussian initial conditions, but it's non-linear gravitational clustering that involves correlations between Fourier modes, and it goes non-linear. So, but it's nevertheless a kind of weirdness. You know, most kids are normal when they're young, but some of them become quite weird as they get older. And the universe is kind of like that, because even if it starts out Gaussian, it'll become non-Gaussian just because of the non-linear processes. Sure.
So given that you lose so much information by getting rid of the phases, why is the power spectrum such a widely used...
There are two reasons. One is that the power spectrum turns out to be, if you're really interested in cosmological parameters, that's the parameters of the background model, then what you really want to know is how just the growth rate of the separate Fourier modes. And that is actually in the power spectrum. But it doesn't it wipes out all of the phase information, but it is very sensitive to things that you like to know about if you're interested in the background cosmology. The other reason, which is probably a stronger reason in practice, is the fact that as you go to more complicated statistics in the power spectrum, it becomes very, very hard to extract it from data, real data, with all of the kind of crappy stuff that data has, like selection effects, pieces missing, errors in measurement, and so on. All of these tend to become amplified when you look at more sophisticated statistical measurements. So the other the reason why the power spectrum is used so much is that it's very robust. You can mess around with the data and it actually doesn't change. But of course, you can't detect weirdness with it. It's simply blind to that. Okay, so let me here's a couple of examples of things that could be weird. Again, so this is primordial weirdness I'm starting here. Many of the people who work on inflationary models model the fluctuating gravitational potential as a Gaussian with some kind of quadratic correction added onto it. And this parameter, F, is a sort of nonlinear parameter. So this will produce if this thing here is Gaussian, then this quadratic correction to it produces a non-Gaussian tail. So this is an example of a fluctuating field which could be stationary, or homogeneous, statistically homogeneous, but will be non-Gaussian. It'll have some sort of tail. And the other possibilities for weirdness are, of course, if you have non-stationarity, so you have the varying statistics. That can happen in a number of different ways. If I've got time, I'll talk a little bit about small universes. This is models with compact topology. The other thing that can happen when you're looking at the CMB sky, for example, is that you have inhomogeneous statistics around the celestial sphere because of something to do with the way you're making the measurements. And that will show up in statistics, and it's also quite difficult to get rid of. So anyway, just to summarize, weirdness is equal to non-random phases. I'm going to skip, I don't want to spend too much time talking about Fourier mode, so I'm actually going to skip this a little bit. What I want to do is sort of give you a hand to visualize how you can see this phase information. And one of the problems of doing things with phases is that their angles are sort of periodic, they wrap around 2 pi. But there's a useful visualization tool, which I've used quite a lot in this talk. You can use this thing. I must admit, I thought I'd invented this a few years ago. It turns out everybody uses it in all kinds of different fields. It's not new at all. The idea is that you can parameterize color using this parameter called the hue, which is periodic from 0 to 2 pi. It's different from the usual RGB scheme that you use on computer graphics. And so you can use this. Imagine if you want to plot a Fourier transform of something, say a two-dimensional Fourier transform. Each pixel in the Fourier transform is basically a complex number, but you can encode it with the color to show what the phase of the Fourier mode is. And that's some way of seeing what kind of patterns are developing in the phases. I'm going to skip across. So I'll skip this technical stuff. So let me just show you this. This is an n-body simulation. And this is a part of the Fourier transform. With the I've left the information about the amplitudes out, but I've left the phases in. So you can see as the thing becomes more and more non-linear, you definitely get this some kind of correlation in the phases. There's a pattern there. It's actually rather like Harris Tweed. Do you ever, not quite old enough to be wearing Harris Tweed, but. But you see also as this structure gets big, this is hierarchical clustering, so structure is growing from small scales to large scales here, kind of winding up tighter and tighter in Fourier space. So that's a typical reciprocity thing that you get in Fourier dynamics. Now, I've shown you this just because it's kind of fun, but also partly to show you that there's something noticeable about this picture, and that is that there's the same amount of red, green, and blue in this final image as there was in the start. So if what you do is just bin up the phases, the Fourier modes, and see whether they're uniform between 0 and 2 pi, you'll actually get the same answer at the end as you did at the start. The one-point distribution of Fourier phases actually doesn't contain any more information in this case than it does. But you will see that different Fourier modes are correlated with neighboring ones. And that's what you have to look for if you're going to detect Fourier phase correlations. Now let me just skip that. One of the things that you can do just to illustrate this is if you take not just the individual modes, but take the difference between the phases of neighboring modes, just as an example. Remember, if the phases are random, that should also be random. So that should produce a picture like the mess. That's, it's actually like the TV in my apartment, actually. Looks just like that. Doesn't work very well. And but if you have correlations between neighboring modes, then what you should get is a predominance of one particular color in this representation. So this just shows you this. Here's some snapshots. This is an n-body simulation, hierarchical clustering in the expanding universe. This is the distribution of the actual phases. You see it doesn't look much different at the end in terms of the total. You're not supposed to resolve this. You're just supposed to perceive the total amount of red, green, and blue in each of the images, right? So there's the same amount there as there is there. But if you take the differences in x and y directions, you see this is much more yellowy and this is much more red. So the neighboring Fourier modes are definitely correlated as you go. I'm just using this to motivate you. This is actually not much practical use for anything, but when I'm going to talk about the CMB, it'll help explain what I'm doing. So there's a list of some papers there. If anyone wants to know, you can have the PowerPoint later. Right, so now as I said, there's this problem that you can't really. What happens in the galaxy clustering case is that when at late times, like 14 billion years late, you have a lot of nonlinear evolution until this point, galaxies forming, and it's actually not very close to the pristine initial conditions that were laid down after inflation. But when you look at the CMB, you've got a chance of seeing that kind of thing. You're looking really closer to the primordial epoch. So you can apply all this stuff that I've just talked about here to temperature fluctuations on the CMB sky. And the only difference is that you use spherical harmonics. And this slide is a copy of the one I showed you earlier. Exactly, everything carries through exactly the same. You even have this reality condition. The only difference really is that the phases of the different harmonic modes, if you decide your z-axis is going to be somewhere else than where it is, there's a very complicated relationship between the phases of the modes. It's more complicated than it is in a Fourier case, but that's just a technical thing. So, again, skip one there. Again, what people do, as you've seen this, there's a lot of debate about whether these funny features in the W-map power spectrum actually mean anything. There's the deficit of power on very large angular scales here at small l, which people have made a big deal about. There's also this kind of strange dip, the spectrum around about the peak. And of course, as I said about galaxy clustering power spectra, this is really great if you want to read off cosmological parameters. because provided you think the model is, the underlying model is right, there's a lot of sensitivity to the initial fluctuations spectrum and the background cosmology. However, as I said before, it doesn't necessarily contain a great deal of information about the weirdness of the universe. So here, I'm just going to illustrate this with a couple of pictures. This is possible foreground contamination for the WMAP satellite. Actually, one hopes that it's in the background rather than the foreground. This is something badly wrong. But this is the height of the Earth above mean level, basically. So you see the Andes here, the Himalayas. Antarctica's very high up, so you see a lot of red there. And the depth is blue. Now, how is this different from the CMB? Well, what you can see immediately is that there's a huge amount of large-scale power in this distribution. It's very long wavelength modes with high amplitude. But it's also very non-Gaussian. Okay, so there's phase information in here. And I can illustrate that by showing you... Oh, it's just subtracting the dipole. This is the famous picture of the WMAP data, I think it's from Physics World or whatever it was a few years ago. So what I've done with this map is just put it on the same temperature scale as the one before. You see that it's actually a lot smoother than the Earth. It looks very, very homogeneous now when you put it on the same scale as before. You can also see quite clearly that there's a bit of galaxy still left in this map. It's known that that's true. There's nothing controversial about that. The foreground subtraction of the galaxy isn't perfect by any means. So what I've done now is done the same thing as I did with those Fourier transforms. Like I've taken the Earth and the WMAP, and I've swapped the phases of the Earth with the phases of WMAP in inverse Fourier transform. So what you have now is the WMAP amplitudes with the Earth phases. And now you have a map with exactly the same power spectrum as WMAP. But it doesn't really look like WMAP. Right? Looks like Earth. So that's just to illustrate that you could hide an awful lot of weird stuff in the WMAP map and not know anything from the power spectrum about it. Okay? Now, I want you to do this the other way around, which is, before you do this, imagine this in your mind's eye, if you can, what the opposite of this would look like. What would the WMAP data look like if it had the Earth power spectrum? I'll show you the Earth. There's the Earth. There's WMAP. Actually, that one's probably a better one to look at. So you can think of this as like applying a really weird low-pass filter to the WMAP data, right? Because there's lots more large-scale power on the Earth than there is in there. So have you all got your mental images together? You've seen it before, so it's not. So the answer is, when I first saw it, I was quite shocked. The answer is that.
Say again, what's
this? This is the WMAP phases with the Earth amplitudes. So what's happened, actually happened here, I've kept the same phases as the WMAP data, but effectively boosted the amplitudes of the large-scale modes with the Earth power. The Earth power, you know, the C of L plot that goes like this. For the Earth, it just goes like that. There's a huge amount of large-scale power. And I think you see quite, obviously, there's this dirty great hole in the middle of the map, which is actually obvious when you see the original picture. Just looks worse on this one. Okay, that's this guy here. This comes even stronger because you clear out a lot of the high frequency stuff. But you can also see something like the galactic plane very clearly, and there's also apparently quite a large north-south asymmetry. All of these things have actually been argued about with proper statistical analysis, but I think you're probably, most people don't believe statistics unless they can actually see the result visually. So this is just a way of helping you understand those results. The map is actually quite inhomogeneous. And if you don't believe me, what I've done here is I've put one of these is the map you've just seen, or at least the dipole subtracted version of the map you've just seen. and the other have the same power spectra as the Earth, the same amplitudes as the Earth, but really random phases. So this one is the actual WMAP phases with the Earth spectrum, and these are random. Now this is like a beauty contest. It's very, very subjective, but most people think that this looks different from the others. I'm not going to quantify that using some kind of psychometric analysis, but okay. So you can actually now. How much time have I been going? About half an hour. Okay. So how do you actually do this? Now there's lots of ways of analysing this map, and I think those of you who Kate Lang gave a talk here last week where she looked at some particular things. I'm not going to go in exhaustive detail about these. I'm just going to use a couple of methods of illustration to show how you can do statistics with those pictures. One of the simplest things you can do with the phases is just to look at the phases of the Fourier maps, basically, and see whether they're uniform, and the differences are uniform. And of course, the phases of all the spherical harmonic modes are not statistics. They're just a representation of some of the information in there. So you still have to think of some combination of those phases for your whole data set, which will actually tell you something useful. And that's kind of hard to do, but you can do very simple things and get positive results out very quickly from the WMAP. And this is what we've done with a student, Patrick Deneen. Now, I just wanted to digress a little bit about statistics. I don't know how involved people are with the different ways of approaching statistical testing. There are basically two schools of thought who are at each other's throats a lot of the time. It's your Bayesians and your frequentists. And generally speaking, the Bayesians like to think of a statistical approach which is actually in theory space, in some sense. So they do an inference. You use your data to infer which model is better than another model, and you compare models with each other based on the data. Frequentists, generally speaking, work in data space. So they have a hypothesis, but they basically test the hypothesis using the data. They simulate the data using their hypothesis and test the data against the simulated data. Now, I'm actually going to, if there's Bayesian, and I don't know, let's take a frequentist approach. How many Bayesians are there in the audience? There's one. One's all you need if you're a Bayesian. So, I discuss this with a lot of people. I've got I really like the Bayesian approach. The Bayesian approach is fine if you know what you're doing. Right? And what I mean by that is that if you're going to decide between two models, you've got to have two well-defined models to parameterize, to work out the priors and all the rest of it. If all you have is a null hypothesis, which is that the data is Gaussian, then you don't know what the alternative is, all you can do is shoot the hypothesis. And that means you do the testing in data space rather than hypothesis space. So this, just an illustration of this, is a frequentist thing. So if you know what you're doing, probably you should be Bayesian. But if you don't, it's still fun, and you can use a frequentist approach. And the advantage these days of the frequentist approach is that Monte Carlo realizations of your hypothesis are very cheap. It's quite easy to do a forward calculation. You know, take your known hypothesis, simulate what the universe would look like. You can do it 10,000 or a million times and then refine your statistics that way. The inverse aspect of the Bayesian approach is kind of difficult. So as I was saying, if you do things up here, you tend to be a Bayesian. If you're down here, you tend to be a frequentist. It is true that most theoretical astrophysicists are Bayesian and most observers are frequentists. I'm not saying that proves this classification to be right, but it's kind of interesting sociological thing. Now, I put this on as additional evidence for the fact that all good statistics were invented by astronomers. This is a very beautiful, one of the things that about frequentist approaches, which is really good, is it brings you into contact with really elegant non-parametric statistical approaches, things based on order statistics and maxima and minima. So there's this beautiful test for uniformity of angles, which involves basically sorting your sets of angles and doing something very similar to the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, but taking account of the periodicity. And this Kuiper is actually the Kuiper, whose belt is famous for being full of little comets and things, or whatever they're called. So you basically test this thing, and you know, you can Monte Carlo up your distribution of your test statistic here and find out whether the universe is weird or not. So, now I'm not claiming actually on the basis of this that WMAP is weird. The only thing weird about WMAP is that it's taken so long for the second data to come out. But the results of this test are quite instructive, because actually these are abbreviations for the foreground cleaned maps. They're actually significantly weird. And that shows up quite strongly if you look at the differences of Fourier modes. Just take that reference down if you actually want to read the details of this. I've had to skip over the statistical details. But what the next slide I'm actually going to show.
But WMAP is not weird at where COBE is?
No.
How can it be weird at the given value of L?
Well, it just means if you take that value of L, you have a set of M's, right? ALM for that value of L. And you look at the phases of those just for that L.
Just the
M's. Yeah. So you can do it over all the different modes, but it's kind of interesting to separate the scales out and you can get a better idea of what's actually happening. I mean, the weirdness we've got at L equals 16 is not the same weirdness as the other thing. And in fact, these are the most weird modes.
You mean the distribution is non-Gaussian, very bad?
Well, I'll show you what it is. I mean, it's no surprise what we found, believe me. I'll show you a picture in a minute. So I'm not claiming anything primordial about this. This is just, you think of this as a software test more than anything else. So that is what this guy should look like if it only had L equals 16 modes in it and all the phases were random. So that's a Gaussian sort of sky map with only L equals 16. All the M's just kind of crammed together with the same amplitude, actually, just to illustrate it. Now, if you take the L equals 16 from the WMAP data and reconstruct it using the real ALM, you get that.
Wow.
Now, I don't think that's a surprise. It's the galactic plane. And you know that it's still there. And you know that there's a big hole down here which is avoiding this as well. So that's why the kink is there. Okay? But nevertheless, it tells you that this map has problems. Right? And you ought to be very careful.
But the people who are the WMAP experts claim that the foreground compression with RC is done in 5 different frequencies, and they swear that it's very keen.
Well, no, it's the best you can do, but there are regions of galactic emission that are very flat. It is synchrotron emission, which has a very flat spectrum. It's very difficult to separate that out using simple models. But let's just go back to the ILC map.
You can see it. Right?
You can see it's there.
Yeah, just close your eyes.
If that's not galaxy there, what is it?
So what is it, 16?
Well, good question. The way it is, the way they subtract the galaxy from WMAP is they use zones. The foreground emission varies across the celestial sphere. So they divide it into zones, a patchwork quilt of little zones, and they model each zone and then subtract them. And each zone corresponds roughly to the angular scale that you've got there. So it's something to do with the resolution. That's what I think it is.
Did you check the error maps that are showing the market?
Sorry?
Did you check the error maps in the market?
The TEGMARK
map is, it's actually, it's TOH there. It's actually worse than the ILC.
But is it always L equals 16?
Yeah, the L equals 16 is the one that gets it wow when you show it to an audience, which is why I've got it on here. There are others which are marginally significant and don't align with the galactic plane.
So is that because the cells that I use to correct the data sort of are natural in the L equals 16 bases?
That's probably got something to do. I'm not even convinced, I mean, we can have an argument about how all of the other stuff that's in here might not be galactic even. But this is some, I'm very nervous about claiming there's anything primordial about this, because it's this one certainly looks like it's the galaxy. And I'm being conservative, I tend to think that there's actually more galactic contamination in the maps than people like to think.
What about the L value near the first acoustic peak?
Oh, well, that's much higher than this. Unfortunately, there was a PhD student who did this. We only have the computer resources to go up to about L equals 20. It's kind of tough to do the Monte Carlos for very much higher L. Think about how many more combinations of modes there are. So I'm going to show you something about that later on, if you just hold on a moment. This is limited to L equals 20. I mean, it's another advantage of these non-parametric things that you can do them with only a small number of data points as well. You look at differences and orderings and things. So when you've only got a few modes, it's kind of good. So there's WMAP. I just wanted to remind you that actually the WMAP data isn't perfect, never intended to be. This is a plot of the signal to noise produced on the map just by the scanning strategy of the WMAP satellite. It scans in the ecliptic direction, ecliptic pole direction. So there are, I mean, you see this stuff in here which is cut out, but basically the signal to noise is determined by how many times the satellite scans a particular point. And obviously, if it's scanning in a polar direction, it visits the poles much more than it visits the equator. So you get better signal
to noise. After you've taken out the motion of the galaxy?
Yeah, the dipole is not in this. Yeah, that's another thing. Actually, an error in subtracting the dipole also propagates into the other mode, so that's a whole other story. It's not easy. It's not as easy as you think to do this kind of thing. This is a message to the understanding. Now, I wanted to show you, now there was a bit of incredulity when I claimed that the galaxy was still in here. Now, let me just briefly mention a few other things. I'm not going to have time to do the north-south divide. You probably have talks about that. Kate probably talked about that when she gave a talk here. I want to, so this is an interesting thing. What I did, I had a new PhD student who had done a physics degree, and like me, he avoided all the statistics. And I wanted to think of something to do so he could learn how to do statistics with real data sets. And I had a collection of extragalactic radio sources in a catalogue, and each of them had a Faraday rotation measure. Those of you who don't know what it is, it's a measure. It's essentially the if you have polarized light, the left and right-handed polarizations travel at a different speed along a magnetic field line if there's a magnetic field. So that rotates the plane of the linear polarization. So the rotation measure tells you something about the magnetic field that exists on a line of sight from you to the radio source. Right? Now, to cut a long story short, it is thought that most of the Faraday rotation of these extragalactic sources is actually produced by our galaxy's magnetic field. Except for the ones where, you know, radio sources are big things with jets and things. If you look right down the spout, you see an enormous Faraday rotation, which is clearly intrinsic. But these, it is thought that the bulk of this is to do with our galaxy. And indeed, the rotation measures that you get from these extragalactic sources are consistent with what is known about the magnetic field and the electron density in our galaxy. So I said to Patrick, I said, go and take this catalogue, there are sources all around the sky, and cross-correlate them with the WMAP data. And make sure you get zero for your answer. Because the WMAP data shouldn't know about the galactic magnetic field. So this is actually the distribution. There's about 1,000 radio sources in here. And all I've done is color-coded them so that the sign of the Faraday rotation, it's the sign of V, determines the sign of the Faraday rotation. Now this is, again, this is kind of spoiled a little bit because there's a ghost of all of these points on the picture. But this is like one of these psychological tests. It's whether you can see any large-scale pattern in there. And I think if you look at it enough, you see that there is actually, there's more black down here and more white kind of here. I'll actually show you a better map later on, because so this, when I show you the maps later, I'll explain what that is actually all about. The funny thing is that if you cross-correlate this, you find that it's positive detection of correlation fit cleaned CNV maps. So there's something in the WMAP data, which is supposed to be primordial CNV, that knows about the galactic magnetic field. And even if you cut out the galactic plane, you still get the correlation. Now, I think the obvious way of interpreting that is that there's some foreground still floating around. Anyway, now it's the point where I start to digress rather badly. I looked at that and I thought, there must be some way of using this data to make a map of the galactic magnetic field. But you see, the point is that radio sources are actually clustered on the sky. So some of the information in this pattern that you see is to do with the clustering of the radio sources, and some of it is to do with the sign of the Faraday rotations. So what we did was to the obvious thing to do is just kind of smooth the thing with a filter or something and join the dots, essentially. And that's what you get. Doesn't really look particularly interesting. There's a better way of doing that, which is essentially to, if you want to, I just really like the maps, I'm going to dwell on this a little bit, is that actually what you should do is think of the galactic sky as, so there's the galactic sky, but what you're doing is looking through a mask, which has basically got lots of little pin holes in it. And so you're essentially just seeing where you happen to get a random line of sight that's taking you through the galaxy. So the thing to do is to actually expand the sky in spherical, in what are not spherical harmonics, but are harmonics that are orthogonal on the masked sky. And that gives you a good statistical estimate of what the large-scale distribution would be. So basically you orthogonalize your... So having this mask basically means the spherical harmonics are not orthonormal anymore, but you can produce a set of them, which is, so they're combinations of the original spherical harmonics. And the result is this, actually rather nice. Actually, three different catalogs. And I just, you'll see how stable the structure is, except in the middle. Now what are you actually seeing here? You see actually much clearer this asymmetry, this and this. One of these is positive, one of them is negative. This is the local spiral arm of our galaxy. You're actually looking along a spiral. The magnetic field is entrained in the spiral arm, so it comes kind of in and then out. You see positive Faraday rotation along one arm, and when you look in the opposite direction, you see a negative thing because the thing is going the other way. So this is actually what the galaxy looks like. You see that actually what the magnetic field involved in our spiral arm actually extends quite a long way above and below the galactic plane, because it's very local. You're talking about a structure in the galaxy which is maybe only a kiloparsec scale object. So this may also be evidence that there's something floating around the galactic sky which is not quite subtracted properly. Alright, so I'll skip the Ericsson et al. Stuff. I wanted to show this because it goes back to this is work done by a former PhD student of mine, Lung Yi Chang. And this goes back to the colour-coded stuff. So let me do cosmology in colour with spherical harmonics now instead of Fourier modes. So this is what I've got here. So imagine this is a spherical harmonic transform of the WMAP data. You have L going from 0 up to, I don't know, 500 or something. Those are the Ls that you can measure. M goes from minus L to plus L, but there's a conjugate relationship between those. So we don't need the guys over there. We just have a triangle. And you'll notice that there's a red line, there's a thin red line up here, which is to do with the fact that the zero mode has to be real in order to satisfy this conjugate. So that's zero is real. And these are random. These are the phases of the actual spherical harmonic modes. So what I did is I've got what you have here is the WMAP data at the top left. And to help you make a comparison, there's really random phases in the bottom right. So if you look at where they join up, you probably see the biggest difference. Even from the back, you ought to be able to see that there's quite a fingerprint, kind of a thumbprint effect along here, indicating that these modes are really correlated. And just to expand on that a little bit. If you take differences in the harmonic modes in this direction, you see this becomes red now because there's nothing to difference with when you go above. See the preponderance of this single colour, which is telling you that there are mode correlations at very high levels. Okay, so this is round about, this is higher than the L of the Doppler peak. There isn't much evidence of anything weird around about L equals 200, which is around here, but there's certainly a lot of stuff going on at the top there. And
not due to beam smearing or something like that.
Oh, it's probably ringing and all kinds of stuff. Up, you know, there's all kinds of things that it could be.
So what kind of L is that? The maximum
value? The L, what, up at the top here? Yeah, it's a, the L will be, I think it's about 500, 400 or something. So 200 is somewhere in the middle. Okay. Now again, this is really just a proof of a neat way of visualizing stuff rather than saying there's anything primordial about that. I'm going to skip this, I think.
The answer, is there evidence?
Oh, right. Oh, well, I'll just quickly say this. One of the things that's been suggested about the WMAP data is to do with this. Before I go on, let me just say one other thing. Remember that I've been talking about these Fourier phases and showing up weirdness. And you're probably a bit scared at how weird the maps actually look. But you have to remember that even if you have virtually zero amplitude, you still have a phase. So there's, you can do quite a lot with the Fourier phases that doesn't necessarily damage the power spectrum too much. And there is, on the basis of what we've done with the data, there is very little to suggest that there's enough amplitude in these weird features to really significantly affect this. What worries me, what going on up here, I mean, which is where you really, this is, the position of this guy is really what you want to know about for the primordial parameters. What is odd is the behavior of the power spectrum down here, the low L modes. And that it's not just that there's a small amplitude, but also the direction, the preferred directions of the modes seem to be correlated. And that is really weird. The statistical method that we've used here doesn't pick these things up at L equals 2 and 4, just because we don't have enough, there aren't enough numbers for our statistic to work very well for those. But it is interesting to speculate as to what the origin of this is, and I think people put their money in different directions. I would say that I think this spectrum is too low because of overzealous subtraction of the foregrounds. And I don't think that's a very popular view, but imagine what could happen if you have CMB-like stuff which you think is foreground and you get rid of it excessively, then you can actually suppress the
power. But more conservatively, you have shown that there is trouble at L equals 16, so you would say anything below L equals 16 is unreliable, never mind what the correct explanation is.
Why be around?
Well,
you could argue that the galaxy is basically a quadrupole.
Yeah, I mean, at low angular momentum, I mean, obviously at L equals 16, there is a lot of trouble or a lot of correlation with the galaxy. So L equals 16 itself is not reliable. Yeah,
but leaking only is upwards.
But I suspect if you go to higher L, you're only sensitive to very small angles or small angular openings in the sky. And then you're much less sensitive to noise. So I would say, I mean, that just correlates with the fact that below L equals 16, it's unclear what goes on anyway from that shading of the data.
Well, then, yeah, that's because, you know, you have one sky and you only have, each sky just gives you a few numbers to do with the quadrupole. You don't have an ensemble average.
Yeah.
Whereas up here, an average over the sky approximates quite closely to an average over the probability distribution. So there is that problem there anyway. And there is a problem of how exactly you track these things and exactly what the correlations, the residual correlations
are. What are the size of the cosmic variance?
Sorry?
The famous cosmic variance is a small L.
Yeah, well, that's what this is.
The shaded.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. I don't really like the word cosmic variance. It makes it sound grander than it actually is. so that's what the shaded area is. So you're basically not as, I mean, if you don't plot the grey area on, you get a really carried away, and then you plot the grey area on and it becomes, you know, slightly curious.
Is
L
equals 16 the point which is obviously off the line, or is that higher?
Oh, well, these are band powers as well. They're not single L modes. So, yeah. So L is 16 is kind of there.
So if you're conservative, you would throw it at that.
If I were conservative, I would do that. The bottom line is that with all of this, that the data has to be, you know, as WMAP goes on, there'll be better spectral information, there'll be better chances to clean the foregrounds, there'll be more information about what's really going on. And this is all preliminary data, and you shouldn't really jump one way or the other with great vigour on it. It's interesting, but I don't think it's something which you should leap to conclusions about. It's just wait and see. One of the suggestions for this death of power here, dearth of power, or both, is the idea that you might have a weird topology. Now, this is weird according to my definition of weird, because the idea is that you might have say something very close to a flat universe but with a compact topology. So you're actually seeing around the universe, just illustrated with this a cube. Nobody believes this is right, but the idea is when you look, you see, so the universe is periodic on these spaces, and you'd actually see a repeated see the last scattering surface, you'd see matched circles and this kind of thing. So this would be weird because it's not statistically homogeneous. There are actually correlated directions in here. And so we've actually done a paper where we've checked to see whether there's any evidence in the mode correlations you see in WMAP for the kind of mode correlations that are introduced by this. Because it's one thing to say, now it is true that these models suppress this power spectrum, right? There simply isn't enough space to put big Fourier modes in. So you're not going to get power on very large scales. You can't fit them in this box. And that's why it suppresses the power on large scales. But if you're going to appeal to this mechanism, you inevitably break statistical homogeneity. And so you have a way of constraining whether this is true. And the answer is no, you don't see any evidence in the WMAP data for this period, for the inhomogeneity, the statistical inhomogeneity that you get.
No, what about S3? I mean, the sphere is probably homogeneous, but also compact. Not a torus, but it's very homogeneous. You mentioned that there. Why would that break homogeneity? Still, if we were living on the surface of a free sphere, then it's not a free sphere.
Well, I mean, it depends on the scale.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can, I mean, you basically, the parameter that comes into this is that the ratio of the scale of the topological scale to the scale of the last scattering surface. So you can have a universe with a topological scale which is a million times larger than the last scattering surface, and you'll never know anything about that. Okay.
No, I think it's true that S3 would cut off the power. We are introducing an isotropy.
Possible. I haven't really thought about it.
Well, which of the first people?
Exactly.
It's a circle.
Yeah, it's a question of how much damage you're willing to do elsewhere in order to get this.
Yeah, I guess
it's quite interesting because all the methods that people have thought of to sort of change that little bit of power, there are all kinds of mess of that elsewhere.
People have looked for front-to-front circles and these topologies, and they have excluded them. What's left is matched circles. What do you think about that?
Well, as I say, this method doesn't specifically look for these. It's just looking for a kind of generic outcome. It's a generic non-statistical homogeneity test, if you like. So if you design something with a particular topology in mind to look for particular things, you get a lot more power that way.
But it's essentially a curious thing. You could have like a fundamental domain that's just larger than the last scattering surface. And you'd still get all these and as
it would, yes.
But
yeah.
You wouldn't get much surface.
Yeah.
Well, the circles, I think you've excluded, I think it's over 30 gigaparsecs is the minimum size.
Yeah. Because we're beyond the greatest velocity.
34 gigaparsecs. So yeah. It is the circles in the space.
Yeah, so you do see a relic of it, even if the topological scale is bigger than the scale of that.
If he's near summary, well, maybe we should go into summary and continue the discussion.
Thank you. So, let me just wind up there. There's one key thing that I haven't said yet, so I'll just summarise the other things. I've concentrated on this idea that you have Gaussian primordial fluctuations. Actually, the message to take away is testing that is actually quite hard because of the fact that it's quite hard to test intrinsically because it's a complicated hypothesis. But also the data, even the very high precision CMB data, has enough kind of peculiarities about it that it makes it quite difficult. The WMAP data is weird, but I wouldn't like to bet on whether it's actually something to do with the universe or just some artifact of the map making process or anything like that. Now the big point here, I think, is that if you believe me that there's evidence that there's some crud in the CMB maps, then, and especially if it knows about the galactic magnetic field and other things, then the business of subtracting the foreground for the polarization maps is going to be very, very difficult because the polarization signal is typically a few percent of delta T over T. And if that few percent is significantly polarized, if the foreground is significantly polarized, then it's going to be quite difficult to model that. And I don't know what the origin of the delay in the WMAP subsequent year releases is, but I speculate that it's correlated with the fact that the polarization is very difficult to do. And finally, I'll just say that there isn't any evidence, as far as I can see, in WMAP for any weird topology. And I'll finish there.
Lots to talk about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, how much would you just give up on the idea of doing an all-sky map, but just cut it off the strip that comes from the galaxy and map all around it, and maybe just take space on the restricted data?
Well, of course, it is. One of the big selling points of the satellite experiments is that your all-sky map increases. I mean, basically, the quality of the statistics you can do, if you can subtract the foregrounds, is great. If you can't subtract the foregrounds, then obviously you lose a lot of that power. But I think the problem is that you really want to know what the galactic foreground is doing anyway, because even if you just use the maximum cut that the WMAP people use, there is still galaxy above and below the galactic plane. If it's very local, 1 kiloparsec scale structure, for example, it need not respect the shape of the galactic plane. We're seeing it from inside, essentially. It goes to quite high galactic latitudes. Lots of the dust and free emission, it appears to be modeled perfectly well. I mean, when you actually do the subtraction, you find the residuals are nice, and you know the spectrum of what you get left is very flat. It's like a thermal spectrum. It seems to work, but then on the other hand, you have these peculiar features that suggest there might be something left in there. So I would take the attitude that you really want to know what the galaxy's doing anyway, to be confident about anything on the CMB sky. The problem is largely to do with the fact that the lowest frequency channels that have been carried by satellites have not been very low. So you don't know, so they're typically, I think the WMAP lowest frequency is 20 something gigahertz, something like that. Everything that's used to make the templates up to that is based on ground-based measurements that are done at 500 megahertz. So you're extrapolating up a factor of 40 something in wavelength to try and make a template to subtract things often it would be great to have an all-sky map at a lower frequency, 5 or 10 gigahertz or something like that, in order to be more confident that the low-frequency bit of the galactic contamination was actually done properly. But you know, that's kind of difficult. I mean, we'll have to wait and see what happens. Every time I ask someone at CETA who's working on WMAP, they say that the data will be out soon. It's been like that for 2 years, I think. But I mean, I think this people are all realizing that the foreground business might be quite difficult. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, is there anybody who hasn't asked a lot of questions already?
Does that count? Yeah, you said maybe it's overzealous foreground subtraction, but I thought, so maybe it's the main question, but for COBE, I thought they also saw a low form. And yeah, this is something I know nothing about, but were the foreground subtraction the same?
Well, it's the COBE subtraction, they only had 3 frequency channels. It's 30, 50, and 90 gigahertz. So the modeling for COBE was the same kind of modeling, kind of, but rather simpler. But of course, you're not trying to match the very fine scale structures with COBE because its resolution is 10 degrees or something. I mean, it's difficult to see how you could do it wrong. I mean, I'm just speculating that that's true. I mean, it's quite difficult to see how you would result in sort of ironing out the CMB. That's essentially what's happening. The fluctuation amplitude on very small scales is suppressed a little bit. So how could you actually get it wrong in such a way as to do that? It's quite hard to see how you would do it. Remember, it's not the mean level that you're showing there, it's the fluctuation amplitude. So you're kind of pushing down the wrinkles a little bit. But if it's not that, what is it?
Well, I mean, one thing is this low L is where you're sensitive to the dark energy, right? Where the perturbations propagate from the surface of mass scattering to you. It has to do with, I mean, as you know, like, if you have different equations of state of the dark energy, and that changes how that plateau looks like. It could be that it's anything.
Or it could be that the universe is Bianchi 7.
Yeah, is it possible to produce weird energy because of scanning strategies?
Oh yeah, well, the way I've defined weirdness, it's certainly true that if you have an inhomogeneous noise on the map, such as if the statistics of the noise vary from place to place, then that would be weird. Now, as best you can when you're doing this, this is another thing which you can do a lot more easily if you do a frequentist method, is you know something about the scanning strategy and you know something about the weirdness that's in the noise. So if you do a forward analysis, you can kind of build that into your statistics as best you can. Because the noise, you don't know what the actual noise on the pixel is, you know what the statistics are. So you can sort of Monte Carlo that in. And most of the analysis that people do try to make use of that. And the other thing is, of course, in the areas where it is known that the residual contamination is quite large, those areas are not really used for determining the power spectrum. So the power spectrum isn't just done by measuring the map. In fact, I didn't bring the picture with me. If you take the WMAP map like this, coloured one that I showed you, you can get this off the web, right? So you can give it to an undergraduate and say, right, measure the amplitude of the spherical harmonics for this map. It actually looks nothing like the top of the map. It's quite astonishing. There's actually a lot more. The actual C of L plot, which you see, doesn't use all of this map. It uses the good signal to noise regions.
Which is not indicated in the picture.
No, it doesn't show on there where the regions are.
No.
This is just a picture. That's all it is.
In the Lunar model, they fitted with omega equal to 1.01 plus or minus 0.02. And by sitting right in there, they changed the whole picture of the universe. Because inflation goes, simple inflation. And you get it. So how accurate can omega equal to 1 become? exclude these people?
Well, of course, I mean, it never made any sense, even in the simplest versions of inflation, omega can't be defined better than 1 part in 10 to the minus 10 to the 5, because that's the amplitude of the density fluctuations at horizon constant. So delta rho over rho on the horizon scale has to be 10 to the minus 5. So that's the kind of irreducible limit on that. Now, I guess if you could get those 5 decimal places on omega and you showed that it was 1.01, you could perhaps deduce something about what the power spectrum was on very large scales, or whether it was actually a globally homogeneous model. I don't know. I don't have anything invested in inflation after that. I'm quite happy to say inflation is a plausible early, kind of model for the early universe, which has some nice features in it. But I wouldn't burst into tears if inflation turned out to be wrong. I don't think there's any compelling evidence for it.
So I think one problem is, if you say that there is some residual program that has not been subtracted, if you do some kind of correction, as you know, a template correction, you actually subtract power. Mm-hmm. I.e., the low multiples will be even lower after you subtract.
Yeah.
So the problem can only be worse if you're saying that there is some incorrected program, except if it's what you said.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to imagine how you could make that kind of error, because you'd have to see something that was actually CMB that you thought was foreground.
It's an explanation, because otherwise it's going to be worse.
Yeah, I agree. So it has to be weird. So it has to be in another way. Weird.
So just to go back to something that was said before, every time you say, oh, there's a bit of galaxy there, it's, the thing you said has been corrected, that can only make the problem worse. If you actually go and correct that, you're going to lower the multiples even more. So the only explanation is the other way around. There should be some stuff there that you should have taken.
Well, it's possible that that hole there represents something that you took out that you shouldn't, because it's coherent on quite a large scale. So it's possible that that does something to the power on that scale. But how you can do that with the quadrupole, which is what you need to suppress the quadrupole, you can think about, how could I really mess up this analysis and go through this? You can think of many ways that you could do it, but how you could mess it up in such a way to do that is quite difficult to imagine. And they're smart people who do it, they wouldn't mess up in an obvious way.
On that note, let's thank you very much. And he is here through sometime tomorrow, I believe, with an office somewhere
in the building.
I think I'm
second floor. I don't know what.